seachtain an Indo-Ascaliga.
Táim I mbun iarrachtaí a dhéanamh teacht ar a chorp, agus súlagam amach anseo gur féidir é a chur in uaigh ceart lena bhaintear féin.
Scíltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara I gcuir na meáin an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gnám go raibh orthcháir na reachtam. Iadach sé tarrann go raibh an orthcháir san I lis dúthail agus gomina fanacht gáir a chloig sár ducha sin éair. Ná ní bhíon ann tar d'oraigh sé sin. Vin Marav.
Seachtain. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
Listen and follow the Left Wing Rugby podcast with me, Will Slattery, and Luke Fitzgerald.
I hope that they kind of keep it calm, keep it measured. I think if you get those things right, I think they've got the best potential and headroom in terms of how far they can go and what kind of performance they can deliver. They'll have a great day.
Every week on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Just a flag that today's episode contains details of murder and content some people may find distressing. Siobhan Carney was just 38 years of age when she was murdered by her husband Brian Carney in Dublin in 2006. Now, her death was so brutal, it was so staged, that the state pathologist, Mary Cassidy, at the time described her as being throttled and garroted. With the prospect of parole on the cards for Siobhan's killer, Brian Carney, who has served 12 years for her murder, Siobhan's family are now reminded once again of the horror that took their sister away on the 28th of February, 17 years ago. I'm Siobhan Maguire, and joining me today are Sunday Independent columnist Bridget McLaughlin and Aisling McLaughlin, Siobhan's sisters, to tell me all about Siobhan and why life should mean life where jail sentences are concerned. Bridget and Aisling McLaughlin, thank you both so much for joining me today to talk about your sister Siobhan. Now, I want first of all to talk about Siobhan, the sister, the friend, the chatterbox. 38 years you had with her. What was she like? Who wants to take this first? Aisling,
Oh my God, I can see you. Shani, I don't think of Siobhan as in the past. For me, Siobhan is always with us and with me. And I'm talking to her every day. So she is a force of nature. Is. And always will be. She keeps us going, because there's no way that I think we would have been able to keep going through this without the faith and love that we have for Siobhan, and knowing that she's with us and helping us to endure this, and also to do the work that was left that needed to be done on her behalf.
There's a lot of sisters and one boy in the family. Where does Siobhan come in?
Siobhan came, she's fifth in the family. And she was, and even though she was fifth, we were all really, really close. And it's only a year between all of us. And she was, as Aisling said, the life force. And it's just interesting being here this morning. Aisling and I were just talking about this earlier with you, Siobhan, because your name is Siobhan. And even that, your name, is quite poignant, to be in a room with a Siobhan. Everything about Siobhan is charged for us with emotion. Mm-hmm. A lot of sadness, obviously. And but we, as Aisling said, she is with us all the time. She was a life force. She was extremely witty, funny, hardworking, organised, immaculately dressed, very, very, very humorous.
Hilarious. Just hilarious, absolutely,
yeah. Hilarious, yeah.
From the moment she came in the door, it was just taking off my dad, my mom. You'll never guess. Look at this. What happened? Whatever. Whether it was her son, she was. The crack was just nonstop. From the moment Siobhan walked in the door, that was it. We were off. There was nothing that Siobhan would do other than bring joy and happiness and fun to people's lives. I've never seen anything like it. She didn't know how to be, I suppose, serious or down. And maybe that was the bad thing, really, at the end of it all, because she wasn't able to show that side. That was not a vulnerable part for Sean, for Shawnee. I call her Shawnee because that's Shawnee's nickname. Sorry, she wants a nickname. But, and I think that probably was, yeah, the downfall, because she always put on the crack, no matter what, even in those last days and weeks, which we now know were her last days and weeks, but we didn't know that at the time.
She was mid-30s when she had Dan, was she?
Yes.
Right,
yes.
Okay. And she met Brian at what age? She was very young,
wasn't she? I actually can't
she?
Talk about him in the first name, to be quite honest with you. If,
yeah. Right. Can I say husband even?
Is yes. That, yep. Yes,
husband,
okay.
Yeah, her husband, yes. Yeah.
So she met her husband when she was quite young.
She was. She was only... She first arrived... I first met him at my own wedding. So that was in the 85, 86. And Siobhan was, yeah, she was
at 16.
20.
Oh, was she
younger?
Was she 20
even? I'm not too sure if she
I
was 20.
She was younger, yeah, when she met him.
But he was 10 years older than her.
Yeah.
Can we go back to that day in 2006? Is that okay?
Yes.
And talk about what happened? Because I'm sure there are people listening who aren't overly familiar with the case.
Yes.
Basically, he staged a suicide.
He did.
Yes, he did, yeah.
But he also, he went, according to Marie Cassidy, when he, and I will come back to that, but he had a moment there, Siobhan, when he could have changed his mind. He had Siobhan unconscious. And he had a moment there to call an ambulance or get help. But he chose in that moment to finish her off. That's what he did. He finished her and then staged it to look like a suicide. This is the brutality of a murderer that is actually being offered parole hearings and reviews, who's never admitted, taken responsibility, shown any remorse for what he's done.
But the fact that that night when she was in her bedroom, she was absolute a neat freak. He had put the Hoover in her bedroom. This is all pre-planned. I mean, Siobhan would never leave a Hoover in a bedroom. You know, just some people would never do that.
Yeah.
And she would never, because I often stayed in that bedroom. No, she would never do it. And then to lock her in the room where she couldn't escape. And she didn't drink hardly. She'd no drugs in her, like sleeping tablets in her body, nothing. She was terrified. She needed to be alert all the time for Dan. And he came in and he throttled her. He strangled her twice. And she was conscious for a lot of it. It takes a long time to strangle somebody, and twice. And then he literally hung her over the door with the lead from the Dyson Hoover. I mean, no words can describe the fear that would cause, you know, for her. Just brute, and her son, the only thing she would have been thinking about was Dan. That was the only thing. So she died not knowing whether Dan was alive. You know?
It's a little three-year-old left in an adjoining room.
Yeah, so he was wandering downstairs. And he made him Cocoa Pops. He gave him a plate of Cocoa Pops and left him there, knowing that my sister Niamh, in fact, Niamh was quite lucky, I think, because Niamh arrived like clockwork every morning. And, you know, she could have been, if she was late that morning, if she'd been earlier, he would have probably had killed her too. Who knows? You know, she was in danger. But like the death Siobhan got was beyond her. Beyond her.
Dan actually recounted to me that he was actually a witness to part of that in terms of looking through a keyhole and hearing his mummy getting sick.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
This obviously would have been talked about with the police at the time. But there was a lot of stuff that couldn't be talked about.
Yeah.
Niamh arrives in. So Niamh is
the younger sister.
The younger sister sees little Dan wandering around.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Realises he says something's up.
He's saying Mammy's dead. Didn't he? Is that what he said, Ashley?
No.
No.
He said Mammy's upstairs in the bedroom. The door's locked.
Door's locked, yeah. And then my dad happened to break the door down. And Mum and Dad coming down, literally, they couldn't stand, coming down, literally on their knees coming down the stairs. We all have post-traumatic stress disorder on a grand scale. And it's getting worse, I would say. To be honest, I would say it's getting worse.
And were there any red flags along the way at all? Or was Siobhan just, as you say, the kind of person, she wasn't going to complain by the sounds of things?
No, no.
She would put the, you know, the best foot forward. But was there any doubt or inklings? Did you like him at all?
No, we never liked him. Never. And that sounds like an astonishing thing to say. But we just thought that he was extremely boring. He wasn't present with anybody, particularly Siobhan or any of us. He disliked us enormously from the very get-go, because that's common practice with people who like to isolate those close to the person. He wasn't demonstrative. He never showed her love or affection. He wasn't generous. He was just so boring. And I remember saying to her, God, Siobhan, what is the attraction? Because she was so vibrant and so unique in every way. She could cook, she could dance, she could sing, she could do hotelier business, she could do anything. And she said, Biddy, he is not a womanizer, doesn't drink much, doesn't smoke, he's safe. Horrendous words, yeah. He's safe. And she wanted stability and a happy family life. And when Mum met him first, Mum said Mum couldn't even, you know, take a handshake with him. She's got a really bad feeling about it. Now, that said, there was no signs of what happened going to come.
They just weren't very...
They weren't.
I didn't feel ever that they were suited.
They were never
and
suited.
It was always a bit of a kind of odd that odd. They were still together. And when they did break up, they broke up once because she, well, they broke up in a big way after being together for a long time, several years, because they'd gotten engaged. And when they'd gotten engaged, he'd asked her for a prenuptial agreement. And Siobhan was deeply hurt by that, because at this stage she was raising his daughter. They were living together. They'd been together for many, many years. And she was absolutely flummoxed by it. She and deeply wounded by the whole. And they did break up, and she was actually really happy, and she had a wonderful few years there where she was, you know, getting herself together. And she did have, definitely, she had a hard time negotiating the fact that she had to get over the relationship. And she went to John of God's for a while, for a period of time. She was there for about 3 weeks. But when she got out, it was Shawnee, you know. She was determined, she was focused, she was back to Shawnee. And it wasn't long before she was back to herself that Niamh reported, as family do, Niamh was staying with Shawnee, and she reported, you're never going to guess who's outside.
Yeah.
No. And we just didn't have to.
Yes. And so she had peered out the window.
And they were sitting in the car outside.
Right.
And she was absent. And that was like, no, not this guy that has caused so much desolation in Siobhan's life.
Then she rang me.
And she ended up back with him.
Yeah, she rang me.
He gave her original engagement rings back. He'd kept them. And he made sure to give her those back. So.
And do you know, Aisling, did he seek Siobhan out? Or?
Oh, he did, yes.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
He did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yep.
She, I remember, because my husband had an accident in the sea, and we were having a big party, a barbecue. And she rang me up and she said, Biddy girl, which she called me, I have to ask you a big favour now. And I was saying, what, Johnny? No, you're not going to be happy, but I have to ask you a big favour. I said, don't tell me you're back with Brian Kearney. And she said, I want him to come to the barbecue. And I just said, my heart sank. I said, please, Johnny, don't do it to us. Don't do it to us. No, I'd like him, please. You're always saying you care for my... I said, okay, bring him. And a minute she walked in, it was just like the presence of someone who was so icky to all of us was there. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but at that time, we didn't know because Siobhan hadn't... That was as much as Siobhan had alluded to, was the fact that he'd asked her for the prenuptial agreement. She never went into any other details, if there were any other details of any other behaviours or anything like that. So we, you know, took it at face value that he was just an unpleasant individual, and like we'd kind of
tolerate.
Thought that she wasn't suited to him anyway. And then the fact that she was ending up back with him, she never revealed any of what might have been happening then until she was pregnant. And at that time, then Siobhan started to talk.
And they had married by this time?
Yes.
Ashing, yeah.
Yeah, they had married. They had married abroad. I don't know if Siobhan wanted... Did Siobhan want to marry here, Bridget?
No, she did. And he wanted... He insisted that they go away to Spice Island and that none of us were invited. Just the two of them.
It was just the two of them. Yeah, I know that. And
this is like so anti... You know, like Siobhan and everything else.
The most beautiful wedding dress that she flew to Italy to get this most amazing wedding dress. But she was on her own. I had to send her a telegram.
I'd send her a telegram as well.
To her hotel.
We weren't invited.
And the pictures are just the two of them. Him with a fedora on and Siobhan and a suit and Siobhan in this just sumptuous wedding gown on her own.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so much you carry around with you on a daily basis.
Yes.
Where Siobhan is concerned, where Shawnee is concerned.
Yes.
Yes.
And do you look back on that period where she was starting to open up and is there, and I'm sure there is a wish or a want that, my goodness, had she just spoken out a little bit more? You strike me as the kind of ladies who would have dived in and
absolutely
swept her out of there.
Yes,
absolutely.
But
there was one
interesting thing that I think is really important for other women that would be listening to this podcast today. And it's something that I have huge issues with. Right? And it's basically when it's a disappear to, you know, this is for all women. When you're in a situation with an abuser or with a man and you want to, you know, leave, you know, get out of the house, separate, and he refuses to accept it. When you go to the solicitor, if there's no history of domestic violence, the solicitor will say, stay in the family home. Right?
I don't know if they still do that, Bea.
Yeah.
Because of everything, all the cases
still,
since.
They still do, though. They
I'm
still
not
do.
Sure.
No, I heard they do. Now, we have a fantastic solicitor and friend, a dear friend, and he was the one Siobhan went to, and he behaved absolutely perfectly professional because there was no history. But now I would say you leave. Now if you say, well, where would I go to? Like, I've no family, I've no this. You find somewhere, even if it's a refuge. You do not stay there for the sake of the children. So solicitors should be saying leave. They shouldn't even contemplate, because every murder happens at this crucial time when they are leaving and the couple are already killing each other. And if they're not, their stress levels are up to 90. And the tension in a house with a family, can you imagine? The pure horror of the whole thing. This is when they act. This is the main time they act, when the girl, woman tries to leave. So I really believe solicitors should say, leave. Not stay, leave.
We've come a long way in the 17 years since you lost Shawnee, but some would say not even far enough yet. I mean, domestic violence against women is
epidemic.
Rampant.
It's an epidemic, an absolute epidemic. And it's like, you know, it's just, it's getting more horror every day.
When you think that when somebody, a man, we'll say in this case, puts his hands around somebody's neck and chooses to murder them, that's a choice they make. And that's obviously an option that some men are still choosing, because it's not actually the end for them. Yeah. It's the end for the victim, but it's not the end for them. They still get hope. They still have hearings. They still have reviews. They've got education. They've got a future as such. So where is the, I don't see anything punitive there that would stop or alarm some young men who are thinking about that. There's too much there to support them after they've committed these crimes. Way too much.
I mean, we always say this, and it's kind of, people are kind of oblivious at this stage to it, but like 15 years. I mean, 15 years to a man was premeditated horrific execution in her bedroom, premeditated, left his own son downstairs, aged 2. You're talking about the most clinical, hard monster that you could invent. And he left her there, premeditated everything. And he's never admitted to the crime. I actually talked to the parole board just during the week, and I'm waiting for answers at the moment. I wanted to know how many prisoners who have never admitted to the crime have been released. That's my big question at the moment. And if they're being released, how could they be? I mean, the parole is an act of grace. That's what it is in America. And this, I want the answers to this. I want to know how many have been released who have not admitted their crime. And sometimes they say, oh, it's legislation. That's what they did say to me. It's legislation.
GDPR.
Yeah, GDPR, legislation. And that can happen. Of course, the cost of keeping these people in prison is huge as well. But, I mean, these are obvious questions. He's in there now and he studied law, he studied Spanish. Early on, he got a gold medal in first stage, which is particularly sickening. He's no worries about his mortgage. He still has his hotel in Spain run by his brother, and his boyfriend. So, like, it's all there. And he has nothing to worry about.
Has he tried to contact the family?
Not at all, no.
In saying that, I would have taken up a lot of responsibility for Siobhan's son, but he doesn't want us to talk about him directly. But Siobhan, I had a lot of responsibility in and involvement in Dan's life, because from the moment that Siobhan died, I was in the courts looking for custody and access for Dan, of Dan. And he was out for 2 years with Dan before he was convicted. So that involved going to the house and collecting Dan for access and going to meeting points where he might be, or at swimming and stuff like that. It was horrendous. When he was convicted, this is a huge thing for me now, Siobhan. When he was convicted, he still retained the right of guardianship under our constitution. He should not have that right. And no person like him who has done what they've done to the child's mother should have that right.
The trauma you live with on a daily basis is bound to, I'm assuming it can only be worsened by the idea that a parole could well and truly happen for him, that he could be out within a matter of weeks.
Exactly. Like, so we have at the moment, we have Siobhan's anniversary is coming up on the 28th of this month. We have the parole going on. We see Mum in bits at home. She's 83. We see Dad, who can hardly stand. He can't bear. Like, he found like his little things in his apartment that, you know, that card Siobhan gave him up on the wall, framed, a cutlery knife that she hadn't called Brewer Street with her name on it. He doesn't even use the knife because it's too emotional. He is, you know, they're totally and utterly traumatised. I'm addicted to Xanax. I'm just off it at the moment, the addiction. But I've been addicted to Xanax since Siobhan died. I mean, I had to just, you know, take a tranquilizer to knock it out. You know, to make myself feel silent, to make myself feel calm.
To numb the pain.
To numb the pain, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm only off it now at the moment for the first time. I'm determined not to be going it again.
Well, don't be.
Yeah. And it's a time that I'd be normally knocking them back, you know, with the parole coming. But I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. No, you don't need to be.
We don't need to, yeah. So all the different things that go on a daily basis, people would have no conception of.
No,
absolutely
they wouldn't.
Not, yeah. The other thing is that the parole, people talk about like data protection and things like, you know, and your information. But the fact that we have to write the letters, we don't have to, but we insist on doing the letters for the parole. The fact, we said this before again and again, Brian Carney can read our letters. He can read everything we write. I mean, how does that make any sense?
No, it's totally unfair. The system it's been changed, but it's been changed, as far as I'm concerned, minutely. In that they now will hear the voices in a physical way in the room with victims, and victims are classed as people who are related to the victim, if not the victim themselves. And also there's submissions, obviously, that people can make. But there's also a new board. It's 13 members on this new board, and the Minister for Justice doesn't have any direct connection with it as previously. One of my issues with all of this is that when I did meet with the secretariat of the parole board, they went through, I had a meeting with them for about an hour and a half, and we went through all the process so that I could bring that information back home. But they refer to the person who's going to have parole or be offered parole as the applicant, but that's actually not the case. The person does not apply for parole. They're automatically contacted with a letter that tells them you now have the opportunity to have parole. So, and it's just a yes or no answer. They don't have to make any submission. They don't have to make a case for themselves. They don't actually have to put any effort at all on their part into it. So then all these agencies then have to get themselves organised, if he says yes, to get all the reports ready to support his, now, his application, if you want to call it. But I actually, what I said to the parole board was, I said, it's more like an invitation. You're actually asking, you're inviting him to parole. And they said, well, it's, that's, you know, and so you, he RSVPs that he's going to do it. And then everybody else has to get moving. The chaplain has to send in a report. The guards have to send in a report. Psychologists, caseworkers, all on his behalf. And it all has to be done within a certain window of time, a 6-month window of time, because all of they all have to be within that time frame, or else it's not valid. And then we get the chance now to have the meeting with the two members of the board. And the secretariat will take notes during that, and a memo is produced. That memo is signed off by all the board, and then it's added to this dossier of all the other reports. That dossier goes to Brian Carney, the whole dossier of all submissions from the family and all his reports. He still has done nothing except say yes. That's all he's had to do, was say yes. Then the parole board will make a date to meet him. The two members that met the families will meet him. And he gets a chance to just verbally have that conversation about why he's eligible for parole, why he feels he's eligible for parole. And that's then based on all of this casework that's been put together for him. And a memo was made of that meeting. We don't get to see that memo. So we don't get to see what he says, why he's entitled to parole. So everything is weighted in his favour.
Has he been out on day release?
Do you know what? I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
But I know that this is his fourth parole application, and I wasn't aware of that.
Okay.
So it was only from the meeting that I asked them, you know, how has he had others? And they said, yeah, this is fourth. So.
Because he got a life sentence.
Yes.
He served 12 years, yeah?
He was part of that cohort, I think, that were able to look for parole after 7 years,
right,
because that was just changed last year,
okay,
from the review in 2019. Mm. So he was able to be a part of that 7 year.
Yeah.
So now that was one of the other significant changes, actually, was that the parole board, they couldn't offer parole now until 12, whereas before it was a ridiculous 7. But he's in that group of 7.
Right. OK. And so it's the life sentence. And yes, I'm wondering, do you ladies feel like you're serving the life sentence?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. 100%.
Of course we are, every day.
And yeah, and not just one, three generations of us, because it leaks down. You know, like,
yeah,
it like sifts down to the rest of the family, to the
yeah,
nieces and nephews who have grown up with the aunts and grandparents talking about this.
Yeah.
And they're older.
Yeah.
Like, it's their friends, a large circle of friends she had. It's really, really tested everybody. It's a daily part.
Yeah, there isn't a day that goes by.
There isn't a day that there's something coming up.
That there is some reference or some
reminder,
pain or emotion to do with Siobhan. It just, the day does not go by that we are not involved with Shawnee. I suppose what I find the most shocking now is that within the first 2 weeks of January, there were two murders of two gorgeous girls.
Absolutely.
And that is just, that was just like kickoff. Okay, so that's kickoff time now. So what's going to happen next? Where is the incentive to try and get underneath this and find out why men are choosing to do this, and why do we have to bring this into another sphere? Do we have to bring this into the classroom and talk to have modules for kids to learn about healthy relationships, about respect, about that this is not the way? I mean, even to use this as an example, that this is not the way to have relationships. It has become the norm.
It's become the norm now. Yeah, it has. Yeah. Yeah. It's become the norm.
And it's shocking. I think it's absolutely shocking that it can happen. You look at Aisling Murphy, you know, you look, the list of women goes on and on and on. And men are not taking their hands off women.
And the interesting thing is that all the women that are killed, right, it's incredible. They all sound exactly like Siobhan.
There has to be a way through this. And I think the only way is education. I really do. Something has to happen in the schools to get the young boys and girls early, to help them to understand about healthy relationships, because what we're doing is not working. And if young men are coming out and young women who feel that they need to be in relationships like that, there's something wrong. We're not doing our jobs. We're not helping these young people to grow into healthy adults.
I mean, it is so recent. We've only started the debate about coercive control.
Yes.
You know. And it's like the latest lingo to be rolled out and discussed, but it has been going on forever.
Forever.
Absolutely forever. And I mean, it was going on years ago as well, like, you know, in the background, always in the background. But when Siobhan died, that terminology wasn't there when Siobhan died. And I think it would have been a huge flag for us.
Yes.
Had it been.
Yes.
You know, had we had the insight at that stage.
And also children, teenagers, as you're saying, should be taught about coercive control, about, you know, the five main types of coercive control. And the main ones basically are isolating you from your friends and your family. That's a major one. Controlling you, usually that's the main one. Literally watching what you do, tracking you down. All of these things are huge red flags. And a lot of young girls wouldn't have a clue. They just think he's been attentive. He's been attentive. He cares about me so much.
It's even hearing the two of you go back over those details.
Yeah.
Could she have?
Yes.
How would this have played out if differently?
Mm. Yes.
And potentially at the end of the day, Shawnee was Shawnee.
Yeah.
And if somebody had set out to kill her, you know, he was intent on doing that.
I remember asking her to come and stay with me.
Yeah.
And I said, because I'd gone through my own breakup years ago and it was very well organised and very decent. But she said, no, he's really good with Dan at night and he reads some stories and stuff like that. So she was always putting somebody else first.
And also then when they were going through this, they had another house right beside where she was murdered. And she was, this is so Siobhan, like, what other woman is going to say, listen, we're not getting on. This is breaking down. I live with Dan next door so that Dan can see you every day. Who else? Most people want to run a mile.
Yeah.
She was actually facilitating him in every way. And he didn't want that. In fact, he rented the house without telling her immediately, you know.
But she'd written him several letters as well.
She'd written him several letters,
Personal letters, because she'd read one out to me actually in the bedroom.
Yeah.
And then when I told the police officers about the letters and that they were in the safe, they went to the safe and they said there were no letters.
And what were her letters?
Her letters were lovely letters saying that, look, it's broken down.
Yeah.
You know, I'll move in next door to the house next door. You know, we both raised Dan together. It's just not working. And I don't want to be in Spain. I don't want to live in Spain on my own anymore. I want to come home, be with my family. And let's just try and do this right. Do it, you know,
mature,
let's make it work.
Sensible way of working it out. Yeah.
But no.
She was going to Spain for a certain number of months every year, was she?
Correct. Yeah, yes. She was going from March, the end of February, until the end of October. And basically there on her own. It's just remembering the day of the day when we arrived there, Bea, as well. Just it's coming back to me when we were all in that house. And that awful journey over that you and I had.
But
when we went to the house,
and
then Mum had to call him and tell him to get back. And she never told him why. She just said, you need to come back to the house immediately. And he came into the house. And the first thing he said he went to you.
Yes.
And he said, oh, Bridget, I'm so sorry, especially after everything that's happened.
To your Michael.
To your Michael.
My husband drowned. And that's the first thing he said to me, which is completely out of context. Why would he say that?
He was alluding to Michael maybe perhaps having taken his own life. He was trying to feed this narrative.
Of suicide.
Immediately.
Immediately. I remember a doctor came in and he was doing this fake palpitating, Brian Kearney. And his sister was rubbing his back.
I'm just so grateful that the science prevailed.
The science forensic people in UCD.
Yeah, the science was amazing.
Only for the experts in UCD. They were brilliant, actually.
Siobhan could not have died by suicide the way he had imagined it would play out. Because the flex, and we had to look at this door and this flex. We had to look at everything in the courtroom. It was all there. The door was brought in. She couldn't have, because that particular flex would not have been able to hold her weight long enough for her to hang herself. And that's how they were able to, and they had to test it. They had to do it in court. They did the test in court.
The pathologist, I recall, used the words throttled.
Garrisoned and throttled, yeah. Someone asked me what I would do if I was on my own in a room with him, like if I was in a room just sitting with him, like, say, in a prison or something. I wouldn't say anything to him. There's nothing to say to someone like him.
But I remember sitting beside him in courts and stuff like that, in the family courts.
Disgusting.
Sitting there and you're just looking at his hands. All I would look at is his
hands.
Hands, thinking.
They were around Siobhan, what I mean.
You know? He has proven he's not rehabilitated because he has shown no remorse or accountability for his crime. So he has absolutely proven that. So is this just a jigsaw puzzle exercise then that has to be, tolerated by the parole board, that they encourage, these guys to go through, but that actually could prove disastrous for families? All we can do is just hope that this country and the people who make these decisions are going to take cognizance of the fact that not enough is changing at the moment for the people who are coming now, all the young boys and girls who are coming up the line. Not enough is changing to help them and support them in making and having healthy, respectful relationships as they get older. They have a responsibility. The people who can make these decisions have a responsibility to start including in the education, to start including self-defense for girls, to talk about it. They need to talk about this huge, huge elephant which is roaming.
And a very big thanks to Bridget and Aisling McLaughlin for joining me today. I'm Siobhan Maguire, and today's episode of the Indo Daily was produced and researched by myself, recorded and edited by Cian Sinnott. And don't forget, if you've been affected by anything in today's podcast, you can find a list of helplines at independent.ie/helplines. If you enjoy the Indo Daily, don't forget to like, follow and leave us a review.